From Washington, this is BOA's International Edition. Coming up, experts question the legitimacy of Crimea balloting. The OECD reports a social crisis in homes hit by a bad economy.
Children living in these households are doing particularly poorly now and also in the future.
The strong trend of faith-based films. And Iranians prepare for traditional New Year's celebrations. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian President Vladimir Putin's moves to annex Crimea have angered the United States and European Union. Putin has declared a vote in support of the majority Russian region seceding from Ukraine legal, saying it has always been a part of Russia. However, as VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnro reports, many outside experts are raising questions about the legitimacy of the balloting.
The reported results of the referendum in Crimea were overwhelming. 97% of those voting cast their ballots to join Russia. The announced voter turnout was over 80%. Russia's President Putin said the referendum complied with international and democratic norms. But many analysts, including Robert Legvold with Columbia University, questioned the outcome.
If it was an honest vote and all groups had participated, I would have thought rather than an overwhelming vote, it would have been something like 52% to 53%, given the percentages of the percentage makeup of the groups in Crimea. The fact that it's 97 point whatever, and they report a turnout of 83% creates some suspicion that it wasn't just the shadow of the Russian military presence, but maybe even some manipulation.
Matthew Rojansky with the Wilson Center says pro-Russian authorities in Crimea would not have held a referendum if they didn't have a high confidence in the outcome.
My sense is this was a product of the times in which there's been a real buildup of fear-mongering and the overt pressure of armed men. There's nothing quite like a gun in your face.
The United States and the European Union described the referendum as illegal and violating the Ukrainian constitution. Washington and Brussels reacted swiftly, imposing travel bans and trade sanctions on 28 Russian officials and 4 Ukrainians. The White House said those targeted are Mr. Putin's cronies. Once again, Matthew Rojansky.
The people that Putin really relies on, are close enough to him that, A, they're prepared to lose. They are easily prepared to suffer the consequences of those individual sanctions. And second, Putin has specifically helped them to limit the consequences of those individual sanctions.
Rojansky says over the last year and a half, Mr. Putin urged senior Russian officials to divest themselves from their international holdings. In other words, bring their wealth back to Russia.
Anybody who's complied with him is sitting pretty and doesn't have to worry about the international sanctions. And anyone who didn't, well, it's their problem, and he can cut them loose.
Rojansky believes the current sanctions are not strong enough, given the fact that Russia has invaded another country. U.S. officials have made clear more sanctions will come if Mr. Putin continues to move against Ukraine.
I don't think Putin believes us. I don't think he thinks we actually have the guts to impose really biting sanctions on, for example, the energy sector. I think he just distrusts our resolve because we haven't made it clear that we're willing to pay the pain on our side.
Robert Legvold says stronger sanctions could have a negative effect on the global economy.
Every step that escalates the penalty or the punishment also escalates the cost to those imposing the sanctions.
Analysts say it will be very difficult, if not impossible, to reverse what has happened in Crimea. Experts also say it will be interesting to see how far the United States and its Western allies are willing to go to punish Russia for its actions. Andrei Dineshnro, VOA News, Washington.
President Vladimir Putin said he is not aiming to split up Ukraine, but some ethnic Russians say they still want to join the Russian Federation like Crimea. VOA's Jamie Detmer has more from Donetsk.
It is a frigid evening in Donetsk, Lenin Square, but the cold has not deterred a small crowd from maintaining a weeks-long protest against the new Ukraine government in Kiev. They say they want to join Crimea and break with Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. 70-year-old Denis says the new government in Kiev is making everyone poorer and the people of eastern Ukraine can't live with the politicians of the capital anymore. Vera is 62 years old and says she'd like Donetsk to stay in Ukraine, but that ethnic Russians are being forced to ask Mr. Putin to help because the politicians in Kiev don't care about the east of Ukraine and they just think of themselves. Donetsk is in the heart of the Donbass coalfield and is one of Ukraine's major industrial cities. The activists in Lenin Square are demanding the release of an activist who briefly proclaimed himself People's Governor of the region this month. And they praise the actions of Russian separatists in Crimea, who stormed a Ukrainian naval base in the Crimean city of Sevastopol. This a day after Crimean leaders signed a treaty with Russia, absorbing the peninsula into the Russian Federation after a disputed referendum. Ukraine's new leaders are becoming increasingly anxious about the protests in the eastern Ukraine cities that are home to large numbers of ethnic Russians. Protests have mounted, and over the weekend violence flared when more than 5,000 pro-Russian protesters roamed central Donetsk, smashing doors and windows and forcing entry to government buildings. Three have died in the recent protests in eastern Ukraine. Kiev's politicians claim Moscow has been infiltrating Russian provocateurs to incite much of the agitation, an allegation also levelled by US Secretary of State John Kerry. The Kremlin denies this and has warned it is ready to send forces massed on the border to protect ethnic Russians, the initial reason given for seizing Crimea. Pro-Russian activists deny the claims, flashing Ukrainian passports to show they come from Donetsk. The country's new leaders, who replaced President Viktor Yanukovych, ousted in February after months of street protests against his rule, are trying to dampen ethnic Russian agitation by offering reforms. They are promising greater decentralization while preserving the unity of Ukraine, which will give the region, cities and districts broad powers and the funding needed for their development. But one of the first moves by Ukraine's parliament after Yanukovych fled to Russia still rankles here. The lawmakers passed legislation abolishing a law that allows regions to use Russian as a second official language. The acting president vetoed that abolition, but ethnic Russians point to it as evidence showing what Kiev really thinks of them. Atom, a 36-year-old small businessman, says it is too late for reforms. Donetsk should be part of the Russian Federation and says that would be best. Despite President Putin's indication Tuesday that he has no more designs on Ukrainian territory, Ukrainians fear that he may now be preparing more land grabs of ethnic Russian-dominated areas. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
The United States has told the Syrian government to immediately suspend operations at its embassy in Washington and two honorary consulates. White House spokesman Jay Carney said that Syrian diplomats who are not U.S. citizens or permanent residents must leave the country.
Following the announcement that the Syrian embassy suspended its provision of consular services and in consideration of the atrocities the Assad regime has committed against the Syrian people, we have determined it is unacceptable for individuals appointed by that regime to conduct diplomatic or consular operations here in the United States.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry highlighted the number of people killed and forced them from their homes by 3 years of fighting.
We just felt the idea that this embassy is sitting here with representation that we could take seriously is an insult. And we closed it. It's that simple.
New U.S. Special Envoy for Syria, Daniel Rubenstein, said the U.S. wants to maintain diplomatic relations with the state of Syria as an expression of long-standing ties with the Syrian people, something he said will endure long after Bashar al-Assad leaves power. UN human rights investigators say the perpetrators of crimes during Syria's civil war will not escape justice. The UN Commission of Inquiry says it's pulling together an ever-growing list of suspected war criminals on both sides of the conflict for future use in judicial trials. In this latest update on the Syrian war, the UN investigators presented evidence of atrocities and increasingly brutal methods of warfare. UN Commission of Inquiry Chairman Paulo Pinheiro warns those suspected of war crimes they will be held accountable one day. He says the commission has drawn up a list of individuals and entities, military units and security agencies, as well as armed groups and their battalions, responsible for violations and crimes.
The perpetrator list contains names of persons criminally responsible for hostage taking, torture and executions. It also contains names of the heads of intelligence branches and detention facilities where detainees are tortured, names of military commanders who target civilians, airports from which barrel bomb attacks are planned and executed, and armored groups involved in attacking and displacing civilians.
Syrian Ambassador Fayez Kabaz Hamouy rejects the report. He calls it biased and politicized. Income inequality and social divisions could worsen unless governments act quickly, according to a new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. We spoke about the findings with OECD senior economist Herwart Immerwahl.
One of the starting points and the premise for the discussion is that people often talk about a financial crisis, an economic crisis, or even a fiscal crisis. We show that there is also a social crisis that has been produced by these recent developments. We show, for instance, that 48 million people in the OECD area, that includes Europe, the US, Canada, but also Japan and Australia and New Zealand, 48 million people are unemployed now. So that's basically the size of a country in the OECD area. And many more are out of work but have stopped to actively look for jobs. We know that the number of jobless households, so the households where nobody has any earnings, has as much as doubled in some countries that were particularly hard hit by the crisis. That includes Greece, Ireland, and Spain. And we know that these households, as well as children living in these households, are doing particularly poorly now and also in the future. And we know that inequality has increased. So we know that the crisis has affected those who did not do as well even before the crisis, has affected those people more than the rich, who have recovered much more quickly.
You also find that young people are at greater risk of poverty than before the crisis.
That's right. There's a story that the crisis, and that's not particularly surprising, but it has not struck symmetrically. So there's some people, some groups that have been particularly affected. That includes children, it includes youth, but it also includes low-wage workers and low-skilled workers who were often the first to lose their jobs and are basically at the end of the queue when it comes to making use of a strengthening labor market and finding a foothold back into the labor market.
You wouldn't think of more people needing food in this day and age, but in your report you say that there are more people that are going hungry.
That's true. I mean, I think it's important to look beyond headline numbers that one often reads in the media, especially aggregate numbers like total unemployment or even economic output. They hide really the difficulties faced by many people. And one of these ways of going beyond those numbers is to ask people what kind of problems are you facing. And there are regular surveys done in the U.S. and in many other countries on that, and it shows that in about two-thirds of our member countries, about 23 countries, people have reported increasing difficulties in affording the food that they need for themselves and the family. So there's a food insecurity issue. That does not mean, that's not the same as going hungry, but it means maybe not eating in the right way, maybe not leading a healthy lifestyle. And that's of concern both for the well-being of households now, but also for their future health and well-being.
And even education has been affected.
I mean, in principle, it's a good thing if households are flexible and adapt to difficult economic circumstances, because often they have to, because government programs are not always there to help them, especially during times of fiscal cutbacks. But concerns arise when people cut back on essentials, and that includes food that we talked about, also includes health, but also includes investments for the future, important, valuable investments like education. And we've seen that there has been a decline in what countries spend on education since the start of the crisis. And that's a concern for young people and for children as well.
What would you like to see the governments around the world do about all this?
Well, the important thing is to first realize that there is a social crisis, especially in countries that have been hard hit. That's not the situation is not the same across countries. For instance, Spain accounts for as much as 55% of all the job losses in the whole euro area. So some countries have been much, much harder hit, and these countries have to act now to avoid long-term damage and actually higher future costs, also higher future fiscal costs. So further cuts to social budgets need to be done very carefully if they are done, because often these cuts affect those people most who are in the greatest need of support.
Senior economist Hurwig Immerwahl with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development speaking with us from Paris. U.S. President Barack Obama has recognized 24 ethnic or minority veterans with the Medal of Honor for combat bravery after years of being bypassed due to prejudice. The service of the Hispanic, Jewish, and African American soldiers spanned three wars, from the Second World War to Korea and Vietnam. VOA's Amanda Scott has details.
Of the honorees, only three were alive to receive their medals. Vietnam veterans Jose Redella, Melvin Morris, and Santiago Arrivia attended the ceremony and were commended for bravery on the battlefield.
It's unimaginable, the valor that they displayed. Running into bullets, charging machine gun nests, and climbing aboard tanks and taking them out, covering their comrades so they could make it to safety, holding back enemies, wave after wave, even when the combat was hand-to-hand, manning their posts, some to their very last breaths, so that their comrades might live.
The veterans were honored after a congressionally mandated review of thousands of war records of ethnic or minority service personnel in 2002 in an effort, as Mr. Obama said, to make sure the heroism of veterans did not go overlooked due to discrimination.
No nation is perfect, but here in America, we confront our imperfections and face a sometimes painful past, including the truth that some of these soldiers fought and died for a country that did not always see them as equal.
Many of the recipients have received the Distinguished Service Cross, but because of prejudice, had not been offered the Medal of Honor. Pam Elby, an archivist with the National Museum of American Jewish Military History, says one posthumous recipient, Leonard Kravitz, a Korean War veteran credited with saving his comrades during battle, was long deserving of the medal.
I think, at least in the Jewish community, there's always been a feeling that some people were maybe overlooked because they were Jewish. Leonard Kravitz being a good example. You know, people have always felt that what he did really deserved the Medal of Honor, not just the Distinguished Service Cross.
Elby says that although discrimination was not an official part of U.S. military practice, many soldiers were overlooked for either religious or racial reasons.
Unfortunately, in the military, if your commander is an anti-Semite or prejudiced in some other way, you might be overlooked for something or given jobs that you don't want to do. So it's just a general microcosm of society.
This was the single largest group of service members to be awarded the Medal of Honor since World War II. The medal has been awarded to more than 3,000 U.S. soldiers since 1863. Amanda Scott, VOA News, Washington.
It's been called the greatest story ever told, so it's not surprising that for more than a century, Hollywood has turned to the Bible for inspiration. The trend of faith-based films remains strong, with the movie industry producing 16 such films this year alone. Many of them may be forgotten just weeks after the release, while others could become huge blockbusters. So what makes religion-inspired movies successful? Penelope Pulu has this look at the issue for VOA Television.
Our Father in Heaven feeds the birds of the air. How much more will he give to you?
Son of God, about the life of Jesus, opened recently and is doing very well at the box office. Churches around the country are renting movie theaters for their members to watch the film. Philosophy professor Martin Oliver says films that offer a popular depiction of Jesus target Christian audiences.
There is not a singular or particular vision on the part of the filmmakers. That is, they are giving you what you already think you know.
Professor Oliver says the filmmakers took few financial risks because the Christian market was tested in 2004 with The Passion of the Christ. Mel Gibson's controversial movie grossed over $1 billion worldwide.
had an aggressive marketing campaign in Protestant and particularly large evangelical churches prior to the release of Passion of the Christ.
Gibson also had artistic vision, says Professor Oliver, and his violent and polarizing portrayal of the Passion of Jesus mesmerized people the world over.
You must accept God's word.
Son of God is not on par with Gibson's film, and its targeted audiences could be thinning out soon. Unlike Son of God, a redemptive, friendly story about Jesus, Darren Aronofsky's Noah is a heavy, apocalyptic story about the end of the world.
Aronofsky's decision to focus on the wrath of God, and that's a God that we maybe don't want to think about, right? It's an unfriendly God, right? And in that sense, his reading of the Noah text is not a Christian Noah.
What do you want?
You don't know your king.
There isn't anything for you here.
I have men at my back, and you stand alone and defy me.
I'm not alone.
Professor Oliver says Aronofsky's Noah is more faithful to the Genesis story, accepted by Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike. But the film may not become a hit. It got a lukewarm reception in Mexico from a mostly Catholic audience that found it too dark and not reverential to Noah's character. Many Muslims also oppose the film because Islam prohibits visual depictions of their prophets. However, Noah may resonate with people who feel that its environmental message, protect nature or perish by it, rings true in today's world. The fact that the film has impressive special effects does not hurt either. Oliver notes that even for the best religious films, success is still elusive. But if a film has artistic vision, a powerful message, and a captivating story, watching it can be a feast for the eyes and soul. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Iranians around the world are preparing to celebrate their traditional New Year this Thursday. The ancient tradition is also celebrated by Kurds and marks the arrival of spring. Zlatika Hoke reports.
Iranians are shopping for traditional food and other items ahead of the Nowruz holiday or Persian New Year. Celebrations will start on Thursday night with music, dance, and elaborate meals. A festive table traditionally includes seven dishes known as haftsin or seven S's because their names start with the letter S in Persian.
Sofre haftsin, sombol.
The haftin table setting includes hyacinth, samanu, sabze, colored eggs, sumac, wheat, garlic, senjed, bread, cheese, green herbs, health, and above all, the Quran.
Nowruz is a secular holiday embraced by people from diverse ethnic communities and religious backgrounds. Tehran resident Amir Ali Hosseini says it symbolizes renewal.
I am here to buy trail mix and cookies. For me, Nowruz brings about change in everything. Nowruz means renewal and rebirth, not only in nature, but also in one's behavior and one's relationships.
Nowruz is believed to have its roots in the Zoroastrian religion of ancient Persia. The tradition includes lighting fires on the last Tuesday before the New Year. Zoroastrians considered fire a purifier of souls. For most Iranians, it is a time to get together and rejoice.
This is a new year for continuing our tradition of haftin, and also for friendships to grow closer and become better in time. That's it. And also to wish for good health.
The United Nations in 2010 recognized the International Day of Nowruz, describing it as a spring festival of Persian origin, which has been celebrated for more than 3,000 years. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.